This is Eco Radio KC, a locally produced exploration of positive solutions to the ecological challenges we face as we work to create a healthier future for our community and the planet.
On today's program, our guest is Steve Mann, owner Prairie Ecosystems Management, who will speak with Richard Mabian about the environmental movement in the Kansas City area since 2008. Steve Mann has a volunteer history with Eco Radio KC, Cultivate KC, Food Not Lawns, and Sustainability Action Network, and others, and is a permaculture designer. Richard Mabian is an active volunteer on Eco Radio KC, the CEO of Building a Sustainable Earth Community, Sierra Club, and the NAACP. They will discuss how they got started and what they have been able to accomplish. They will consider what they have not accomplished and where they feel we will be going from here. But first, the environmental news for the week of 12/3/18 on Eco Radio KC. My name is Teresa Wilkie. Capitol Hill Democrats, who will soon run the House of Representatives, are prioritizing climate change nearly a decade after their attempts to slow global warming helped whisk them out of power. Party leaders vowed to hold hearings on the Trump administration's aggressive efforts to undo Obama-era climate rules. They demanded internal documents on the Trump administration decisions to scale back restrictions on fossil fuels. They feel fossil fuels contribute to global warming. General Motors kicked off plans to close 5 plants, including the Detroit plant that builds the Chevy Volt. General Motors will continue to produce the Bolt, which runs on gas and electricity. The Lawrence Journal World reports, Kansas Legislative Transportation Task Force suggests new fees for electric vehicles because use of those vehicles reduce states' income from sales tax on fuels. There is increased use of mass transit by many modern drivers, and that is also contributing to reduced income. Democracy Now! Reports, Interior Secretary Ryan Zinke is being accused of using the deadly campfire to advance provisions in a new farm bill. The bill seeks to make logging in federal forests easier by removing the environmental review process. While visiting California, Zinke suggested that thinning forests could help prevent wildfires, but recent studies have found that logged forests with low environmental protections experience more destructive wildfires. Reuters reports, delegates from nearly 200 nations began on Sunday for 2 weeks of talks to tackle deep political divisions at the most important UN meeting on global warming since the landmark 2015 Paris deal to shift away from fossil fuels. Expectations are low that negotiations in the heart of Poland's coal region will be sufficient to address concerns laid out in reports over recent weeks on the severity of rising greenhouse gas emissions.
All right, this is Richard Mabian, and welcome to Eco Radio. And I'm really excited about our guest tonight, if I can call him a guest. I'd prefer to say having my friend on tonight. And last week we did a tribute to our Ben Chelsea, and Ben, as much as that was emotional for me and something that brought back really great memories, the guy that we're getting ready to have on tonight, Steve, is the same way. Steve, why don't you say hello and tell everybody out there hi and tell them a little bit about yourself.
Well, thank you for those kind words, Richard. So some words about myself. Well, I'm a grandpa here in Kansas City. I work as an environmental consultant, and my political views lean to the green side of things, so I'm active in ecological and social justice in the Kansas City region for the last 10 years or so, and I think that's kind of what we're going to talk about tonight is the last 10 years in the environmental movement. What's happened? What do we look forward to?
Very much so. Very good. I couldn't pinpoint where I had met Ben or met you until we were talking last week, and we brought up that occasion, and you know, that was kind of a really memorable group that was on there with John Kerman and also with Jeff Humphill. We were some pathfinders, brother. At a time when there wasn't a whole lot of us around. And I don't want to leave out D-Berry, and I hate start naming things because you'll always end up leaving out some folks. And
But it
just brings back some really good memories. I'd love to be able to have this kind of conversation with each and every one of you, Jeff and with John, because there are some things that we were privileged to that people need to hear about now. We got a different animal out there, if I may use that for lack of a better word, that's entering into this environmental world. You know it and as well as I do. And the foundations that we all had to get started is a little different. I'll tell you what I'd like you to start with, the thing that probably blew my mind when I first met you, and that was permaculture. That guy that had, you had a book on him, maybe he had a video on him. He had a place out there and somewhere in California. You know who I'm talking about?
Well, that's Bill Molson, and he was in Australia, in Tasmania, started out, moved to Australia later. He was a pioneering environmentalist and a farmer and an ecologist, and he came up with this kind of a point of view and a tool for sustainability, where we look at nature as a pattern that we can use to have sustainable systems. Because, you know, a forest or a prairie, if humans don't intervene, they're sustainable systems. They go on and on and on, and no one plows them, no one fertilizes them. Nature has evolved those systems to, you know, be fairly stable and very productive. So this is how we can create a human system, a permanent agriculture, a permanent culture, using the principles that we see in nature. And nothing's permanent because, you know, we have the forces of time and entropy, where, there, you know, energy is always going to be harder to get and capture, and, you know, sooner or later the sun's going to wink out. So we can't talk in the long run of permanent, but in our human scales, we can talk about permanent culture, permanent agriculture.
Yes, and I truly believe it was those kinds of lessons and experiences that taught me the real true meaning of sustainability. Because of, like you said, that a forest or a place like that without any man interventions can continue to last and survive and maintain itself. And you start realizing that that's kind of an example of how sustainability can be. Of course, with humans, you're going to have things you're going to have to work on and deal with. But at the same time, that concept is what has been a driving force for me as far as being able to reach a sustainable earth. You know, also, we talked a little bit about John Rensenbrink the other day, too, when he was speaking in terms of that political issue part of it. And that's something that I like to bring to the table, even though I realize there's a certain degree of politics that needs to be involved because we have policies that need to be dealt with. I think I brought it up last week, but I'll bring it into it again. When he made his comment, and John Rensenbrink was, to those out there listening, was the co-founder of the Green Party, and he was one of the persons that helped set the standards for what the Green Party has become. And his comment when he was here in Kansas City metropolitan region during the 2008 presidential election for a candidate that was running, Terry. You remember Terry's last name? He was in the wheelchair, Terry. Oh, God, he was
Bunker.
Yeah, he was running for attorney general for the state of Missouri. That's what brought him in town. And he was speaking out at D-Berry's house. And one thing that captivated my attention was when he said that that he hoped that the environmental movement was the first movement that had the ability to change policy in this country. And I think that's really important because it has done that in many ways. But he said he hoped that it didn't become that since the civil rights movement, he added that to it. And he said he hoped that it would that the environmental leaders wouldn't make the same mistake as the civil rights leaders and allow it to become a political issue. Steve, I want you to help me with this because I have a lot of problems when I say that to people because they think I'm saying that what they're doing is wrong or that there should be no politics involved at all. Can you make a comment about the incorporation of the two ways of dealing with it?
Well, I can give you my perspective, and I could kind of say that it's an eco-socialist perspective.
We'll let you
and
slide on that.
What we're seeing now is socialism for corporations, and then it's every man for himself out here in the general public and the working people. You know, in 2008 and 2009, all these banks failed because they were gambling with our future, and then we bailed them out. And the guys, you know, made money on it. And this is the socialism they get. But, you know, if people want, you know, universal health care or improved Medicare or jobs that don't destroy the environment, you know, we're socialist. And, you know, they point to these failed socialist states like Venezuela and Russia and China and North Korea and say, well, we don't want that. Well, that's not even really socialism. That's more like corporate capitalism, state capitalism, where the state took over what the capitalists were doing and just continued, and the working people were still just working people. So that's not what eco-socialism is about. It advocates for the common ownership of the means of life on Earth, air. We all own the air. We all own the water. And these, you know, water is being privatized. We have all these issues in western Kansas. They're draining the aquifers out there, and they're polluting the waters, the aquifers with fracking wastes and saltwater injection wells. And so this is what we're up against. And there's a huge propaganda machine trying to get people to, you know, just continue their consumer lifestyle. And it's like, you know, we're in a party on the ballroom on the Titanic, you know, just waiting to hit that wall of ice. It's going to send us to the bottom. So we have to do something about that. So that's kind of where I'm coming from.
Yeah, and I love it because you bring in the a perspective that's not my perspective, but a perspective that I have learned to know and understand. My perspective has to deal with people power. You know, when you live in the inner cities, when you work in the urban communities, your strength is your ability to have numbers. You know, and that's what the system is designed to take that away from you. They find ways, David Corton used to say, they find ways to create divisiveness among you. And they do that with race and gender and all the various things they can use to cause people to be standoffish with one another. But at the same time, because they understand it's all about numbers. In everything that we're doing.
Yeah.
If we were able to, in the inner city, have people be able to control their spending, where they would use their dollars, and it would be based on what that particular place was providing you, it would make a big difference over what we're trying to do. Now, that's a kind of politics, so I'm going to throw that out there and say that is a kind of politics, but at the same time, is the initial steps wasn't a political issue. The initial step was to garner people into their own individual responsibility of understanding what it is that we need to accomplish. In many ways, I saw that happen in Kansas City, Kansas, on Central Avenue, before the Latino community decided to make that their their foundation and build out from there. You know, it was a drug-laden prostitute, you know. It was just a place where nobody wanted to be. And so they went into that area, but they went in there with an attitude that we have to work together in brotherhood and sisterhood. And in 5-10 years, they've turned that place around to a point now it's one of the most thriving communities in Kansas City, Kansas.
It's a perfect example of acting locally to increase, you know, the local business structures of small shop owners and people.
Yes.
Doing good work right on the street.
Right there. When I go back 10 years ago, there was a guy pushing a tamale cart. We didn't even have that kind of stuff going on up here in Kansas City, this part of the country. And I'll never forget going down Central Avenue and seeing this little man with a tamale cart going up and down the streets, man. And from there, it turned into, well, like I said, one of the most progressive business districts in the city. I mean, and when you see it, and like you said, it's all local. It's all local. You know, that one little strip there that has the grocery store, the restaurant, and the whole bit. I mean, it's thriving. I go drive by there. When I leave here tonight going home, I'll drive by there, and the streets will be loaded with people with sacks and bags of shopping. And that's what it's about, buddy. That's another kind of empowerment that can come. And we're not getting the attention to that because of that corporate structure, okay?
Yeah. Well, one of the things I really love about your work, Richard, is you're bringing the spotlight on the overwhelming whiteness in the environmental movement, you know?
Oh, yeah.
Where are the black leaders in the environmental movement, you know, besides you and a few others?
Right. I agree, and it's like a two-edged sword. One, the black leaders not seeing it as being a necessity; they're being controlled by that corporate group that we're talking about that says going to, and I won't put names on stores. I just won't do that. But that's much better than going to the little or having a neighborhood store. My best friend Gary Wilson, who has Wilson Pizza up on Quinn. He struggles to survive because the powers to be will seek out the same thing that he's selling there at his particular place. They will try to find another place, and they'll give their supports behind a mainline pizza place. I'll never forget when Pizza Hut, I didn't name one, and they still have regulations about where their drivers can go and cannot go, and they wasn't delivering pizza into your inner cities. Gary and his wife got together and decided that we'll start fixing pizzas and start delivering them ourselves, and they got one of the best pizzas you can buy in Kansas City, and they started being able to deliver it to the folks that was in their neighborhoods.
Yeah,
and that's a good sign of that what you call it, like a BALE, Business Alliance for Local Living Economies. There's another good sign of that. I wish that we had the other additional support they have up on Central. One day that will be there at Quindell, because that's one of my objectives. We're going to take a break here, Steve, and then I'll come back in, because I want to pick up and talk about one of our first adventures together, okay?
All right.
Before we go, I'm going to throw out the number just in case somebody out there would like to join us or have something to say about what we're talking about. That's 816-931-5534, 816-931-5534.
You never know what you're going to hear on Radioactive Magazine. We might be discussing racism or climate change or Palestinian rights or a dozen other social justice issues, featuring interviews by activists from ACLU, Indivisible KC, Black Lives Matter, many more. Whatever the topic, we promise a thought-provoking discussion. That's Radioactive Magazine's Tuesday, 6 to 6:30 p.m., right here on 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.
All right, this is Richard Mabian, and if you want to join this conversation, come on and give us a call. Don't wait until the last minute to do so. 816-931-5534, 816-931-5534.
Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz.
So that's how the NRA became the largest and most important and powerful white nationalist, legitimate, nonprofit organization. They don't even have to pay taxes. And that's how it has to be seen. Because I hear people waffling saying, well, there are a lot of good people who are members of the NRA. They're not like that. Well, they should leave.
Wednesday, 9 a.m.
A Pennsylvania river reveals its true colors on this current cast.
When I was a little girl, I grew up along the banks of this river, and we used to go splash around in the water, and when we would come out, our clothes would be stained orange.
That's Melissa Reckner of the Kiski Kamina Stream Team. She says the orange was iron oxide from abandoned coal mines. It didn't harm Reckner, but it made the water too acidic for fish and other wildlife. Eventually, the state green-lighted funding so watershed groups could treat the mine drainage before it entered the rivers. Reckner says efforts have been ongoing for more than a decade and will need to continue. But today, people float, boat, and fish in the Kiski Kamina Rivers. And now, if you go in the water, your clothes come out clean. Current Cast, produced with Cornell's Atkinson Center for a Sustainable Future and made possible by the Foundation for Pennsylvania Watersheds. Online at currentcast.org.
All right, this is Richard Mabian here at Eco Radio, talking to a good friend of mine, Steve Mann. Just for those who might want to call, I'm going to throw the number out again, 816-931-5534, 816-931-5534. Steve, after we had our permacultural experience, you started coming to the table talking about no-till garden. Do you want to explain what that is?
Okay. Well, we all know how it smells out in the spring when you till your garden up, right? It's got that, you know, there's actually chemicals in that odor that stimulate pleasure in your brain and produce, a pleasurable response to our senses. But the problem is, by tilling, we're destroying the life in the soil, because when you till, you put a lot of oxygen in there, and there's bacteria in there that will use that oxygen to burn up the carbon in the soil, and they put out carbon dioxide, which we all know is poisoning planet Earth. So, you know, it's not a good idea to till. You know, like I said earlier, the most productive ecosystems on Earth, forests and estuaries around river mouths, are never tilled, and, you know, they're the most productive. So you don't have to till to produce, you know, food and textiles and other things that we need. We just have to do it differently. And USDA, Department of Agriculture, is working on that. They're trying to talk farmers out of tilling, because not only does it destroy that carbon in the soil, it washes the soil, you know, it allows the soil to wash away in a rainstorm. And, you know, the biggest export from Iowa is soil to Louisiana. And it can't go on forever. We've lost probably 60% of our soil because of erosion, 40 to 60%. So we need that soil. That is our life support system. That's where our food comes from. And there's other life in that soil that actually makes it productive. There's various bacteria and fungi that interconnect plants and allow them to, you know, mine the soil for the resources that they need. And it's an ecosystem that is balanced, like in a prairie or a forest, or it's out of balance, like in our agricultural lands, where we've just ground the soil into a dust and it blows away or washes away. So that's one of the big things right there, why no-till is the way to go.
Well, you know, also back in those times, you used to talk about even the cutting of grass. You had a concern about that too, didn't you?
Well, there's 40 million acres of lawns in the U.S. It's the largest crop. There's only about 20 million acres of corn or soybeans. So we're expending a huge amount of resources to keep this crop going, and it's basically, a status symbol for a lot of people. They have this big lawn that someone is mowing, you know, once or twice a week, and it's just not sustainable. And not only that, is most of the agricultural chemicals and pesticides and what I call deathicides, things that kill life, are sprayed on lawns, and they end up in the water supply in our rivers. And around here, they end up down in the Gulf of Mexico, and there's over a 5,000-square-mile dead zone down there that is caused in big part by the, you know, the lawn culture that America is, you know, it's an American fetish, just having a big lawn. Now, and even here in Kansas City, you know, one of our most prestigious spots in town is the Nelson Atkins Museum with its huge lawn with the shuttlecocks, you know, known worldwide, and we we celebrate this lawn. So I wouldn't want to get rid of the lawns. We call our movement here in Kansas City Food Not Lawns Kansas City, and we try to get people to grow food instead of lawns, because it's just the thing that should be done environmentally.
Yeah, that was my next thing, because we went from me learning about from you to start showing people how to create these lawn, these Food Not Lawn. In fact, you had the Food Not Lawn class that you at one time was putting on. Well, I was with you on that as far as that was concerned, because I always had a urban perspective that needed to be brought to the class. And Ben, he was involved with us on that too. And it was basically teaching people about the Food Not Lawn. I mean, you use it for that. That would date back to the permaculture guy that you were talking about, because I'll never forget him walking around his yard picking stuff and eating it while he was walking and talking. Yeah. About it. He would just pick something and just start eating it, man. Yeah,
he gave us a lot of principles to use to create a food system that doesn't destroy the earth, and it's a work in progress.
Right.
And we're learning so much, because we've lost so much knowledge in the last 20, 30 years, where people don't even know how to raise a garden anymore, and right. They have to go to classes. You know, that used to be something that your grandma and your mom and the family took care of, but no more.
Well, you know, and that's one thing that has been a benefit for me in my area, because the people of color still have a tremendous amount of knowledge about gardening, and especially the older ones. And when I started working with public housing, you know, we have a couple of public housing that we have some raised bed gardens in. And when those tenants there, especially the little old ladies, started getting a chance to get out there and get their hands back in the soil, you saw a completely different person come out, and you started realizing how much knowledge that they really truly have as far as maintaining gardens. One aspect that for them is the okra. I'll pick that particular one, because everybody knows that once okra starts growing, you know, you can only let it get so long before you need to pick it, 'cause, you know. And these ladies, it's like they would race to see who could get up the earliest to get out there at the break of dawn to get the okra. And the men, not knowing no better, they would sit there and go, they don't even let it grow. Every time I come out here, it's nothing but stubs. But what I saw was how clean their cuts were. It wasn't like they was breaking them. They would have a very clean cut, because they knew that it would continue to grow. And I sit and watch those ladies. I mean, these were people, man, that before we put those raised beds in there, didn't have anything to do in life. They was just there. And all of a sudden, that, like you was just saying, the knowledge, the natural knowledge that they have. And a couple of them would always say, well, oh, I remember when I was down there in Mississippi. You know, they was born in the South. And they would bring those kind of concepts and talents back with them to that raised bed. It's a sight. It's a priceless sight to be able to experience, you know?
Yes.
So now, at one time, you were talking about doing doing something to your yard. You was going to completely cover your yard with something. It was like little clovers or something like that.
Well, we do what we call lawn eradication using a sheet mulching method. And that's one of the things that Bill Molson popularized, is where you like mow down the spot you want to eradicate a lawn or whatever's there, and then you give it a little bit of fertilizer. Then we use newspapers, and we wet the newspapers down, and we lay them out so that there's no cracks in between them, because what we're forming is a light in a weed barrier. And then we cover it with some kind of mulch, like leaves or wood chips or straw, pretty thick, you know, at least 3 inches. And it's best to do that like this time of year. And then by spring, a lot of that will be broken down, and actually you're creating topsoil. And then you can just kind of rake away the spots you want to plant, and you don't till, and you don't have any weeds because you've eradicated them.
So now you
still have to do maintenance on it, but you're starting out with more of a blank slate to get your crops, you know, going before the weeds can come back.
Before it can come back. Now, that's like if you plant in the garden, because we did that at Wyandotte High School as a demonstration.
Yeah.
And that was, a sight to behold. But the thing you was talking about putting in your yard wasn't necessarily a vegetable crops. They were just like ground covering, right?
Yeah, those are cover crops. And what they are species that have traditionally been grown by farmers in rotation with their other crops to keep the soil healthy.
Okay.
You always want to have something growing, and it's best it's something that you control and something that is productive and gives, you know, return on your work, because you don't want to do a lot of farm work or gardening and not get anything out of it. that's not what you're seeking. You want a return on your work.
Okay. Now, you know, I don't know if I've seen anyone else use the newspaper. You were the first, and even though it may be me and my limited knowledge, but I have never seen anyone else do that.
I wasn't the first, but I saw quickly that it was a pretty good strategy for, you know, creating a place you can grow some food.
Yeah. And it made sense. When we did the demonstration project, for those of you out there listening, we had a rainstorm, and we all showed up out there. And when I say we, it was a community-based project along with the students and the science teacher at the school. And you could see the difference between the two spots. The one side of the garden that had used this method he just mentioned with the newspaper and the mulch, and that side was still standing tall. But the other section that had just been dealt with the regular way, tilled and planted, you could see where the water had eroded. I mean, it was just washing it away. And I think that in itself sold that whole process to me. I knew then that that was a concept that needed to be learned.
Yeah. You're building soil, and that's what cover crops help you do. Plus, you can get, you know, it's in the normal farming system. They can be grazed by animals. They could be mowed, you know, put up for milk cows or hay, horses, and they help give food sources to pollinators that we have to have for fruit and most of our vegetables, and they look good.
Okay.
So, you know, it's a win-win situation in any many multifunctional ways.
All right, so now we've talked about how we got started. We talked about processes that we've been involved in. Now I'm coming to you to see, how do you feel that this movement, this environmental conservation movement, is going?
Well, sadly, like I mentioned before, the mainstream environmental movement is mostly white, middle class people that have bought into the corporate greenwashing that's out there, where they'll be sponsored by like Exxon Mobil, you know. And these are the guys that hid, you know, their scientific research about the effects of climate change for years and are being sued right now for major damages. And you just can't, it's really impossible have a sustainable capitalist system, because capitalism requires growth and perpetual growth. And that's not possible on planet Earth. And so sooner or later, it's going to be a disaster. And
what do you mean it's not possible on planet Earth? Kind of explain that.
Well, there's only so much oil in the Earth. You know, there's only so much coal. And what those resources actually are is ancient stored sunlight. And they're carbon. You know, they were plant materials and animal materials that got buried 200 million years ago and were turned into these resources that we have started using in the last 300 years to raise, you know, our economic system up. Before 200 years ago, when oil and coal were widespread use, there was never more than a billion people on planet Earth. Since 200 years ago, we've grown to almost 8 billion people. So the reason we have those 8 billion people is because we're actually burning fossil fuels to create food. So it takes 10 calories of fossil fuels to create 1 calorie of food. And these are not, you know, renewable resources. These are finite resources. And the theory is that we've already used up half of the oil in the earth.
Right.
Now, we've gotten a big boost in the last few years because of use of fracking and other enhanced recovery methods where we inject water and chemicals into the soil, into the wells, to force out more gas or oil. And we're mining these coal tars up in Alberta and even in Utah now, in Colorado, and extracting, oil resources out of those. But these are poisons. The residue from these things is poison. And we're just dumping it on the ground, and it's fouling the water and causing illness up to the native peoples up in Canada. So all of these, energy sources have social, environmental, and even intergenerational justice problems. Intergenerational justice is the ethic of caring for future generations. And if we owe them anything, I myself think that we do. We don't have the right to create a world that they're not going to be able to live in and prosper.
Yes.
And so we have to find a new way of doing that. And the sellout of the mainstream environmentalists to the big corporations is not getting us where we need to go, because we're going to have degrowth, because growth is directly correlated to the increase in carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. The more growth, the more energy you use, the more carbon dioxide goes into the atmosphere. And Trump is bragging about a 4% growth rate a year. Well, that is killing the earth and killing the future generations' prosperity. We're doing it all now. We're selfishly using the resources of future generations for, disposable beer cans and stuff like that.
Yeah. When you're speaking, I'm sitting here thinking in the work that I do in the inner city, I found more benefit in educating. I hate to use that word of being able to teach the future generation about what we're talking about over trying to get over that barrier with the what would be considered the adult portion of the population. It's just too big an uphill battle. The younger folks are cognizant. I'm amazed at how many families out here say that their children are vegans. They're learning that and bringing it home. They're not really into the meat thing, and so that gives me some hope as far as our future is concerned. But like you said, we're destroying this. And one of David Corton's main comments or emphasis had to do with teaching the future generation how to rebuild this planet after the inevitable collapse occurred. And, you know, as we're going, we're brought right back to where we were before. And I'm not trying to be dismal about it, because there's a lot of folks out here that are really doing a lot to educate that future generation, and I don't want that to be missed, you know? Yeah. All right, we're going to take another break here, Steve, and we'll get back to you. I'll be back in a minute.
Okay. Hello, this is Joseph Jackson. Join me on Cowtown Conversations, where we will discuss matters that impact your life as a resident of the Kansas City metropolitan area, every Thursday morning at 9 a.m., right after Democracy Now!
If you have a car, boat, or truck you no longer need, you can donate it to KKFI, which helps your favorite radio station and gets you a tax deduction. Call Bill at 816-994-7869.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. It's Hanukkah, the 8-day Jewish festival of lights. During this holiday, people light candles to commemorate the Jewish story in which a one-day supply of lamp oil miraculously lasted 8 days. Rabbi Arthur Wasko directs the Shalom Center in Philadelphia. He says this holiday about creating and sustaining light provides a perfect opportunity to work for a clean energy future.
Each of the days should be set aside as a day of doing action to heal the earth.
In his writings and through the Shalom Center, Wasko invites Jews to participate in what he calls the 8 days of action. He suggests a different task each day. Some are personal, like not using your car. Others are political, such as urging politicians to pass laws that reduce carbon pollution. He says Hanukkah is not only a time for spiritual reflection and teaching.
Hanukkah should be a framework for doing the work, that we need to do as human beings. And that's both work at the personal and neighborhood level, and it's work at the national level as well. Our job is to bring light into the dark time.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. Learn more at yaleclimateconnections.org.
Okay, I'm back again. This is Richard Mabian at KKFI. Eco Radio, and I'm sitting here talking to longtime friend Steve Mann. Steve, you work with a bunch of group up there, a bunch of folks up there in Lawrence. You want to tell us a little bit about that experience?
Yes, there's a great group in Lawrence headed by Michael Allman. It's Sustainability Action Network, and it was started about 12 years ago or so. And they work for environmental issues in Lawrence area, policy work. They do policy work. They have a maker space over there where the community comes together to create all kinds of stuff. They have the Clean Air Now Coalition. They've helped nurture. And I think you're a member of that, aren't you?
Yes, I am. That's up there.
Yeah, and they did some pioneering work in Turner at the Intermodal Center, where they did monitoring of diesel exhausts, and they found that the people there were being subjected to intermittent periods of high elemental carbon, which is a particulate matter in diesel exhaust. It's very dangerous and can cause death, and especially the people that have heart conditions or asthma or breathing obstructions. So they were able to document that, and now that I think the EPA has come in and doing a major study on some of these other intermodal centers in Kansas City, and the Clean Air Now people are setting up testing stations all around the region. So we're very proud of that work done there, and we do a lot of work with energy conservation. Recently, they had a electric car showcase at the Lawrence's Merck co-op, where they had just all kinds of electric cars. And the Merck recently put in solar collectors on some canopies there, and now they have a charging station for solar vehicles. So this is the kind of work we do, and we also do a lot of policy work on bicycle and pedestrian transportation in Lawrence, Kansas, to hold the feet of the policymakers there to the fire in regards to planning a new transportation system that we need for the future, because we need people on bicycles and walking, not in cars, you know, right. single use, you know, one person in a car spouting out a bunch of carbon. Even if they're electric, they got to be charged from electricity generated in the power plant. So people on feet, especially in a town like Lawrence, lots of students there could be riding bikes. We have to put in the infrastructure for people to feel safe to ride bikes. So that's some of the work that that group does.
So now how much of that work is outside of mainstream? In other words, it's being directed and designed and produced by organizations that are like environmental organizations over it being some mainstream program.
Well, it has some similarities to a lot of organizations that are around, but I think Sustainability Action Network is unique because they're kind of coming from what we call the transition movement. And Ben Chelsea, what you talked about last week, he was one of the pioneers in this movement where local economies are built up so that we can transition away from this dependence on oil into a post-carbon world. And it's going to be a better world because we're not just going to be clutching and grabbing at stuff. We're going to have to slow down. We're going to have to, you know, rein back the economy so we don't, you know, continue this poisoning of the earth with carbon. And so this is a kind of a, it's not mainstream thinking, that's
right.
for sure.
Right.
But we feel that this is, you know, there's a whole philosophy, it's called the Transitioner's Discourse.
Okay.
And, you know, it talks about, you know, human economy and social and that involves from, you know, our connection to the earth and our local roots and finding the things, the unique gifts that each place on the earth has. And Lawrence is in the middle of the Kaw Valley over there, and that's some of the most productive ground over there as far as, you know, farming.
Right. Now, we got to...
In the river valleys.
We got a couple of minutes left, and what I wanted you to do is to somewhat state where you would like to see this movement we have go. That's what I want to end on with you.
Wow. I could just talk about a little bit about my part of the world up here. I live up by Parkville and Platte County, and we've got, you know, the Lion Creek Corridor. It's a 500-acre forest, one of the last old-growth forests in the region, and it's being encroached on for development. And this is also the corridor of the interurban railway system that used to connect Kansas City with St. Joseph and even up clear up to Savannah, Missouri, back between the 1890s and 1930s. There was an electric train system that connected all these cities in the region. And, you know, when General Motors started producing mass trucks and cars and buses, they put all these small systems out of business. And we're going to have to go back to things like this, an interurban railway charged by solar collectors along the path and, you know, carrying people through the region. Instead of rebuilding I-29, we need to be building these rail corridors between, you know, Kansas City, St. Louis, St. Joe, Lawrence, Springfield,
okay.
Denver.
Okay.
This is the future. I want to see this stuff happen.
I'm glad you said that. I didn't know which direction you was going to go, but you hit it right on. Steve, as it always goes, when you're having a good time, you know our time runs out on this. But I really want to take time to thank you for taking the time to be on here with us and look forward to you and I continuing our relationship. And we'll see where we go from here, pal, okay?
I appreciate KKFI so much for giving people like me a soapbox to preach.
All right. You got that, guy. Take care of yourself now.
All right.
All righty. Good night.
Good evening.
Now the calendar of events for the week of December 3rd. December 4th, 7 p.m. to 9 p.m. is the holiday party for the Thomas Hart Benton Group of Sierra Club, 4501 Walnut, Kansas City, Missouri. December 6th, Green Party KC has a membership meeting, 7 p.m., Westport Presbyterian Church, 201 Westport Road, Kansas City, Missouri. Also on December 6th at 7 p.m., there's a free Slow Money Northeast Kansas Entrepreneur Showcase at the Douglas County Fairgrounds, 2120 Harper Street, Lawrence, Kansas. Slow Money connects ecologically positive food and farm entrepreneurs with local investors so that we, as a community, can bring money back to Earth. There will also be time spent in moderated roundtable discussions about individual farmer ideas and projects. So come prepared to share in a relaxed and friendly setting. For more info, go to Slow Money NE Kansas or Slow Money NE Kansas on Facebook. December 7th, 9 a.m., backpack the Paddy Creek with Sierra Club. Meet at Lake Drive, Plato, Missouri. Contact Chris Cornell at cornellcb@att.net or Matt Verholtz at zionhikes@yahoo.com or call 913-484-2212. Also on December 7th, Topeka Group Sierra Club annual holiday dinner is at Teptim Thai Restaurant, 22220 Southwest 29th Street, Topeka, Kansas. Contact Duncan Whittier at 785-438-7772. Also on December 7th, Sustainable Success Stories will be 8:30 a.m. to 10 a.m. Join the celebration to honor 10 Kansas City Regional Green Infrastructure Projects at the 2018 Sustainable Success Stories Award Ceremony. This year, the Mid-America Regional Council selected stormwater management, transportation projects, and green street initiatives. The award winners will be honored at 8:30 a.m. at the Kauffman Foundation Conference Center, 4801 Rock Hill Road, Kansas City, Missouri. The event is free, but registration is required at mark.org. December 8, Nature Creations Christmas Crafts will be at the Baker Wetlands, 1365 West 1250 Road, Lawrence, Kansas, 9 a.m. to 11 a.m. The program is for all ages of the public. Registration for the event is required and space is limited. Register by calling 785-594-4703. December 12, 1 to 4 p.m., try your hand at a creative painting class using soil pigments from Prairie Birthday Farm in Kearney, Missouri, to celebrate World Soil Day. It will be held 1 to 4 p.m. Sunday at Prairie Birthday Farm, 13318 Plattsburgh Road, Kearney, Missouri. Register for the class at greenabilitymagazine.com. There is a cost. These items and more can be viewed on the Eco Radio KC Facebook page and at the kkfi.org Eco Radio KC program page.
A new way to detect pipeline leaks. That story and more on H2O Radio's weekly news report. I'm Jamie Sudler.
I'm Franny Halperin, and it's This Week in Water.
In an effort to combat climate change and heat homes, the world's largest producer of pork is partnering with an energy company to capture methane gas from waste lagoons.
The Washington Post reports that Smithfield Foods and Dominion Energy plan to cover hog waste pits in Virginia, North Carolina, and Utah, and eventually feed the methane into existing pipelines.
Emissions from agriculture in the U.S. represent nearly 10% of greenhouse gases. Methane has a shorter lifespan than carbon dioxide, but it is 25 times as potent.
By covering the lagoons, it could also keep water from inundating them, which happened during Hurricane Florence when breached pits sent waste into streams and rivers.
The plans are not without critics. Food and Water Watch says on its website that there will still be leftover waste that will be sprayed or spread on lands. The organization says that the Smithfield plans are an effort to greenwash factory farms.
Recently, a jury awarded more than $475 million to be paid by Smithfield to six families in North Carolina because of the noise and odor from hog farming.
during times of drought, some water providers drill deeper into the ground to obtain supplies. Groundwater sits in layers, and at lower levels it becomes brackish or salty and is not potable.
A new study published in the journal Environmental Research Letters shows that there might not be as much drinkable groundwater as we thought. They found that brackish waters are closer to the surface, particularly in the Midwest and further east.
About 40% of all the water used in the U.S. for irrigated agriculture comes from groundwater, and some cities depend on it.
The scientists concluded that in Michigan or Ohio, groundwater is too saline to be an option when supplies are stressed.
The authors say their study also shows that groundwater is being reduced not only by excessive withdrawals, but also by injecting wastewater from fracking and potential contamination from oil and gas development.
The researchers conclude that drilling deeper is not a long-term solution to the demand for additional fresh water.
Coral reefs have declined up to 50% in all oceans over the last 40 years, and a new report from the National Academy of Sciences outlines strategies that might be needed to save them.
One method is to develop a so-called super coral that could survive hot water bleaching events, which can kill the reefs. They also hope the super corals could withstand more acidic waters.
Another solution would be to pump up cooler water from the ocean depths in a feat of geoengineering.
As the news site Earther describes, another option calls for coral embryos and sperm to be frozen and then thawed out when the climate is hopefully cooler.
Mark Eakin of Coral Reef Watch said that these solutions are not supposed to replace efforts to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, but instead, it's what's needed to repair and keep reefs alive despite global warming.
Leaks in pipes that carry water to homes and businesses waste about 6 billion gallons of water per day in the U.S., according to a recent study. So engineers are working on ways to detect them.
Some methods to find leaks use robots, like a device resembling a badminton shuttlecock that runs down a pipe. Another solution uses a handheld probe with a sensor that is placed against a pipe that can lead investigators to a leak.
But researchers from the University of Waterloo in Ontario have recently invented a novel solution. They've designed a system of sensors that's inexpensive and easy to install in fire hydrants, even without taking them out of service.
A release from the university explains that the sensors gather acoustic data that highlights leaks. Artificial intelligence software then develops algorithms to distinguish leaks from all the other noises in a water distribution system.
Researchers are now field testing the hydrant sensors in Canada, where leaky pipes lose an average of more than 13% of their treated water before it reaches users. And finally, Puffin Island sits off the coast of Wales, and it's uninhabited except for a lot of seabirds that call it home, one of which is the razorbill, a black and white bird similar to a puffin. Razorbills spend more of their time at sea than on land, and that presented an opportunity for science.
Researcher Matt Cooper from Bangor University in Wales had fitted GPS tags on the razorbills to study their breeding and feeding behaviors when he discovered that at night, the creatures just hung out on the ocean surface, simply going wherever the tide took them.
And after recording the bird's position every 100 seconds, he was able to see that the razorbills were not only drifting with the currents, they followed the direction of low and high tides, a discovery that he realized could be really useful for developing tidal energy.
Generating energy from tide flows requires detailed knowledge of sea currents, which scientists and engineers have traditionally determined using radar or buoys with scientific instruments. But those methods are challenging and expensive, so if tagged seabirds could provide tidal data over a large area, it might help to locate a good site to place turbines.
Ocean energy, which is being generated mostly in the UK, is seen by many as a promising renewable and a way to phase out fossil fuels. According to Forbes magazine, environmental impact studies of tidal power have shown relatively little effect on ecosystems. However, researchers at Cardiff University have concerns that it could negatively affect marine life by changing how sedimentation, dissolved oxygen, and nutrients circulate in the area. they say more study is needed.
And Cooper says using seabirds to measure tidal currents has limitations since, well, they are birds behaving naturally. But even so, he thinks that tracking their movements could tell us more about our oceans, especially in remote regions where getting data is challenging.
This Week in Water is sponsored by the American Water Works Association. Explore new trends in technology at ACE 19, June 9th through 12th in Denver. Learn more at awwaace.org.
Thanks for listening to Eco Radio KC on 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.